Hello and welcome to The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell, and today we welcome David L. Robbins. David Robbins is a name that I'm sure you're going to be familiar with. He's internationally known as a novelist. He lives in Richmond. He is a good friend to the Virginia Voice, and we thank you for that, David. He is a founding board member of the Podium Foundation, and next in line, he is a playwright. His play, Scorched Earth, will be opening at the Barksdale Theater soon. And David, I want to talk a little bit about that, the move from novel writing to playwriting, and how this all came about.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here. And
thanks for coming.
I am a large admirer of the mission that the Voice has, and thank you folks for listening. Scorched Earth was one of my favorite books, and for the people who have read my work, I often hear it's their favorite book. It was my attempt at Southern writing. And a lot of my other books have been historical novels, large-scale things, World War II, that kind of stuff, middle of the 20th century. Scorched Earth was a contemporary book, and, you know, as a Southerner, I view it incumbent upon me to weigh in upon Southern issues. And, you know, key in the Southern mind is racial relations. And so Scorched Earth has always been a dear book to me. The topic is a church burning, a racially mixed baby is born, buried at a white Baptist church, and that night the white Baptist church is burned because they had voted to exhume the child.
And move it.
Yeah. And this actually happened in Georgia. So it was rooted, the story is rooted in a real thing I read back in the late 90s. So I always marveled that people could do that to each other. We could vote to exhume a mixed-race baby because it has blood not of our own. So I've always been fascinated with that story, and I think I wrote it in a way in Scorched Earth that resonated with a lot of folks. About a year and a half ago, I had a health issue. I was stuck in the house. I wasn't going anywhere for about 4 or 5 weeks, just some skin cancer treatment. And I used that time because I looked like a red raccoon. I had this big splash of red across my face from where all these skin cancers were being burned off. I used that time to adapt the book into a stage play, more as an academic exercise, never really dreaming it could actually one day have a place. But I've written for a while, written a lot of different topics and formats, and I'll be honest with you, as the book was turning into a stage play, I could sense the bat hitting the ball. I felt the story translating itself very well to the stage. And not being an experienced playwright at the time, I had my hopes. You know, I wasn't sure. When it was done, I showed it to a couple people. One of them, my friend Bennett Fidlow, who's a local entertainment lawyer, very smart man. Bennett showed it to the guys over at Theater 4, Bruce Miller and Phil Whiteway. They asked me if we could have a table reading. So they put together some of the city's best actors and actresses, Joe Insko, Irene Ziegler, Scotty Wichtman, a lot of people, names you'd recognize.
And, names we do recognize.
Yeah, and they were all around the table, and they gave this thing just a killer reading. And when it was over, Phil walks up to me and says, well, we're doing this. It is an incalculable thrill for me. So that's kind of how it came into being. It was sort of an academic exercise while I was convalescing. And then, you know, gave it to some people, and their enthusiasms manifested in it opening at Barksdale on April 13th.
I'm curious about how it feels to have other people bringing your work to life. And what I mean by that is when you're writing a novel, it's all you. You do all of the creating. You control all of the words. When you write a play, you lay down the words. But those actors, those directors, those lighting designers, those set designers all become co-creators of that final piece. How does it feel to be sharing something that is so close to your heart?
A great question. I have an advantage in that before I ever published a word, I spent 14 years as a freelance writer here in the city of Richmond. I worked for some great ad agency people. Tom Kennedy and Gary Green come to mind, two of my dearest friends. I did a lot of work for a lot of ad agencies, and I learned early on about that kind of creative collaboration. I would write an ad or write a TV spot or a radio commercial. And then for 14 years, you had to watch an art director take your words and turn it into a brochure. He'd cut things. This doesn't fit. He'd turn things sideways. And you got to where you understood there are different forms of the same piece of art. Like water can be found in a liquid form or as ice or steam. Still water, but it's three very different forms. I learned that a story is the same way. A story can be ice, steam, or water. A story can be in a book, it can be in a play, it can be on screen. It could be read only, so all you hear is the voices and you see nothing. I'll say this, that I'm having the best time with what might, I think, aggravate a lot of other writers. I'm having an absolute thrill with the collaboration. For so long, for 15 years and 10 books, it was just me. I'd write it, I'd work with an editor quietly on the side, and, you know, making it better.
It's a lonely life.
Oh, lonely begins to scratch the surface. And it makes for an odd personality, which I suppose I'm blaming a lot of my quirks on the fact that I'm a writer. But writing a stage play, I've begun to work with Steve Perrigard, the director that Theater 4 has given the play, and he's a bloody genius. We've had one wonderful meeting and two phone conversations, and every time we talk, the play gets better. His depth of knowledge of the story rivals my own, may even eclipse my own. He brings a real breadth and depth of knowledge to it. I know a couple of the cast members. I'm just thrilled what they're going to do with it.
Can you tell us who they are?
Well, I not really know, because I don't know that it's written in stone.
Oh, okay.
Bring me back in a month and we'll know. I have my hopes, but I mean, that's not my issue. I mean, that's Theater 4 and Steve's. I mean, they cast. I'm not consulted, nor should I be consulted. I really get a tingle thinking about the collaboration. I get a thrill looking to see what somebody else's creativity, what their artistry is going to do on top of mine. It'll always be my story, but it becomes their play.
Now, will you be involved right on up to opening night?
I'm going to sell popcorn if they let me. Yeah. We haven't started the rehearsal process yet. Steve tells me that starts late February, early March. But yeah, we'll be refining the script, and I'll be involved only on the written word. I'm not going to have anything to do with how it's directed or how it's put on. That's all Steve Perrigard's. Nor should I. I mean, these people are every bit as good as I hope I was when I wrote the story. They bring their talents and their prodigious talents, and I would only curtail the expression of those talents if I got involved. I don't expect to get involved, and if I feel like opening my mouth, I hope I have a good sense to close it.
It's a terrific story, and for our listeners who are interested, the last time David was with us here on The Writer's Voice, he actually opened that program by reading the beginning of Scorched Earth, and that is online at the Virginia Voice website right now, so anybody who would like to pull that up and listen to it can. I want to ask about future plans. This sounds like it's a great experience. So are you thinking about adapting others of your novels or writing or turning to more play or even screenwriting?
Yeah, another good question. Thank you. I currently have a screenplay that looks like it may go into production. It's, again, Bennett Fidlow, who I referenced a little while ago, and Lucas Crost, a local film director, came to me with the kernel of a beautiful idea set just in the days after the Haitian earthquake. So I wrote a script from that idea, sort of in collaboration with Lucas, kind of sitting on my shoulder, you know, helping guide it, because it was essentially his main story idea. That took me about 5 weeks, and I'm pleased to say that script won the Virginia Film Office Screenwriting Award for me. I've never won anything like that, so that was a thrill.
Is that your first screenplay?
That's my first anything, yeah, my first screenplay.
Wow.
So that won that award, and then they took that screenplay out to California, showed it to some big agents, and those big agents liked it very much. Then they told Lucas, who is a very accomplished director but hasn't done a feature-length film, they told him they needed to see a 5-minute video trailer to say, okay, well, let's see what you would do with it. Let's see your vision for this. And the trailer was shot here in Richmond in November, and then Lucas edited, you know, right up to the last minute. Then he and Bennett flew back out to California, met with the agents, and apparently hit it out of the park. The trailer was fabulous. And so now we're hoping that in 2012 we'll have the financing and the cast to actually make this movie. I'm so amazed that I wrote one stage play and it's going to be debuting at Barksdale. I've written one movie script and it looks like it might actually happen. So if these two things go well, and I'll tell you why they're going to go well. because at this point they don't have anything to do with me. I mean, I wrote a play and I gave it over to brilliant people. I've written a movie script and I've given it over to brilliant people. I'm kind of now just, I'm no longer driving this bus. I answer the bell when they need me. When Steve Perrigard, who's directing Scorched Earth, says, hey, I want to refine this scene, or what do you think about this paragraph or this speech, I answer that bell. I go, okay, well, let me work on that. Same thing with Lucas and Bennett when they say, hey, take a look at this scene in the movie. Take a look, refine this, shorten this, lengthen this. I answer the bell. But what I really like, as opposed to books, which is all me, it's all me, my name, my words, my ideas, my everything, you know, and then some help from an editor. But still, even it's my karma and my luck. You know, I don't think I can screw these things up because I put them in the hands of really good, smart, lucky people, and they've been moving forward kind of without me. I actually, in a sort of reverse, perverse way, really like that. I like the fact that other people are admirers of my work, and then they say, let me use this as the platform to express my own artistry.
That's exciting, isn't it?
It really is. I'm not just being politically correct here. I'm thrilled to hand my stuff over to good people that I, even if I didn't like and trust them, I'd be thrilled. But to like and trust the people I'm working with, like the people at Theater 4, again, like Lucas and Bennett, I like and trust all of them. So it's a double thrill for me because I'm pleased to see them excited. I'm pleased to hope that they'll do well. And, of course, when they go, I go.
To use your words, they could ring the bell and call you back in for additional work on both of these pieces, but it sounds like you're at the point where it's time to be on to the next project.
Sort of, yeah. In fact, sitting on my desk right now, I've got about 98% of another screenplay that I've been writing over the holidays, this time without the skin cancer.
Are you superstitious, or can you tell us a little bit
about
it? No,
I'm not superstitious. Oh, nah. Yeah, it's a... I and you, and probably a lot of the listeners, are children of the Cold War. And I've always been fascinated with that. You know, I think the United States has staggered a great deal without a real, tangible, three-dimensional enemy. You know, this whole war on terrorism is so shadowy and it moves on us so much, we just don't know where to swing and who to oppose. But back in the day, man, we had the Soviet Union. They were like the bad guys. Black hats, white hats. It was easy. I'm oddly reminiscent about the days of Eisenhower and Kennedy. I wrote a play called The Brink. A screenplay called The Brink. Now, the reason I've written it, parenthetically, is because I'm one of those people who believes that you prepare for failure. You have the bomb shelter dug in your backyard just in case you need it. But you also prepare for success. And because I've been very enthused and excited about watching the stage play be snapped up by other people and run with, and the same for the Rock and the Sun, which is the screenplay for about Haiti, I'm hoping that those things will turn into success and some attention outside the book world, but in the play and stage world. So I said, well, if somebody looks at me and says, hey, what else you got? I don't want to go nothing. I want to go, well, here, I got this.
Right.
So I've written another screenplay. And now I know how to do it. To be honest, when I wrote The Rock and the Sun, I was making stuff up. I had no idea what to capitalize. I just was lost. So I'm shocked that it did as well as it did and won that award. I fully intend to go back and make it look more professional soon.
You know, I meant to ask you,
yeah.
Did you go to Haiti? I mean, what was the research?
No, that's the beauty of being the writer. The people that film it and design it and direct it have to go to Haiti. I don't. I get to say rubble. I get to say a church is destroyed. I don't have to go see it. I can look online and see how awful it was. A sad statement, but one that I think has got some sagacity behind it, is there really aren't that many ways for the human being to suffer. I mean, in the course of writing 10 books and traveling really to some weird places and talking to some extraordinary people, and in my own experience, I think I can mine the emotional cave of humanity well enough without having to actually go to Haiti. It's not a story about Haiti. It's a story set in Haiti that's amongst people. At this point, I feel like I know people okay. Now, when we shoot it, yes, we'll obviously have to go to Haiti. And but it's more incumbent upon the directors and the designers to actually see these places. Now, for a novel, I would never have tried to do a novel. without having gone to Haiti. I would never have done that. I've never in my life depicted a physical setting in any of my novels I haven't seen, from Auschwitz to the Ukraine to Cuba. I mean, I always go. But for that's kind of a earmark of stage and screenwriting, is I'm just doing action and dialogue. I'm not doing these long, in-depth descriptions to really paint the picture like you would have to in a novel. That's gone.
That's going to be somebody else's
job. The visuals do that in a movie. On screen, you really see Havana. You really see Haiti. It's not incumbent upon me to describe it in poetic and excruciating detail that moves the reader. The visuals do that.
When you were writing, back to the more recent one that you've been working on, when you're setting a story in the Cold War, is it suffering? What are the emotions there that you're dealing with?
Well, I'll tell you the story real quick.
Okay.
They say when you do a screenplay, you should have an elevator pitch, a one-sentence elevator pitch. In case you're ever in an elevator with Spielberg, you can say, Mr. Spielberg, what do you think about? So my one-sentence elevator pitch, if I can remember it, is a beautiful, in the weeks before the Berlin Wall, a beautiful East German woman becomes a courier and a pawn between a powerful Stasi agent who's decided he must defect to the West and the former disgraced CIA agent he had tortured.
Sounds exciting.
That's my elevator pitch. To flesh that out a little, it goes this way. My dad had MS, and so I'm kind of familiar with the infirmity. And in the story, a very powerful Stasi agent, you remember the Stasi, the secret police in East Germany, it is said that one out of six East Germans was an informant, which means you can't have a dinner party without somebody informing on it.
Mm.
And that's how ubiquitous the informing was in East Germany. Well, this guy, he's a colonel in the Stasi. His name is Wolf. He learns he has MS, the opening stages of MS. Now, there is no health care available to speak of in East Germany at this point. Most 4,000 or 5,000 doctors out of the 6,000 doctors in East Germany have fled to the West. In East Germany, they can't prescribe Western medicines, they can't read Western medical journals, and they can't go to Western medical conferences. So whatever's left is the healthcare in East Germany. So Wolf, who's been an advocate and a powerful man in the state security organs for East Germany, decides with MS, I got to go west. There's no health care for me here. I'll just die broken. And when he's talking to the doctor tells him, he says, Herr Wolf, you'll experience general weakness, but you can take heart. MS very rarely shortens lifespans. You will not die from MS. To which Wolf responds, correct, doctor, I will not die from MS in my profession. It's the weakness that kills. And so Wolf decides he's got to go. You can't stay in the Stasi and be limping around with MS. So he wants to go west, but he just doesn't want to walk across the border. He's got to orchestrate this because he's got a head full of ideas and a head full of secrets. He wants to sell them. So he has to contact somebody in the West to orchestrate his defection. The $500,000 in the Swiss bank account, the apartment in London, the health care, the immunity from prosecution from major Western nations. Someone's got to handle all that. So he contacts his former, his counterpart in the CIA, a guy named Angel. And Angel, but 2 years before the story starts, Wolf had kidnapped and tortured Angel, emptied him of all his secrets, eliminated all of his agents in East Berlin, then threw him back, a drained and broken man. So now, obviously, Angel hates him with an obsessive passion. Angel's a very bad PTSD case. He doesn't sleep at night, and he'll choke Wolf with his bare hands the moment he gets within arm's reach. So Wolf picks a woman, because he knows Angel's head as well as he knows his own. He spent 4 months rummaging around in it, beating him, torturing him, asked him questions. So he picks a woman that he's calculated that he knows Angel will fall for, and innocently tells her, he says, look, I need you to take some messages to West Berlin for me. I can't go. Do it for me. So she, because she's in the East Germany and there's not much adventure over there, she kind of says, well, golly, this guy's charming. He's handsome. There's a kind of a powerful aura around him. Okay, what the heck? She already works in West Berlin anyway. This is before the wall. So she takes messages. Of course, the message, when Angel gets it, he finds out it's from Wolf. He slams her against the wall. He's like, what are you doing? Who are you? You come here from that guy? Because this is his bête noire. This is his nightmare. And the message says, hey, hi, it's me, you remember me, and I need to defect, and by the way, if you don't do everything I say, I'll kill the girl. but he can't tell her that. So she doesn't know she's a pawn. She doesn't know she's a hostage. She thinks she's just a courier. What happens in the story is both men fall for her. But she picks Angel. So when she picks Angel, that endangers her life with Wolf. So and then the whole thing falls apart. He can't cross for various reasons. But then the night that his crossing fails, the Berlin Wall goes up. And she, Ava, is trapped in East Berlin behind the Berlin Wall with this crazed, powerful man who's sworn to kill her if everything doesn't go his way. Well, everything didn't go his way. So now Angel has to get her out before Wolf gets to her.
This sounds like a real thriller of a movie.
One hopes. So I'm almost done.
You're writing the screenplay first?
Mm-hmm.
Would you possibly follow up with the book? What's going on with the books right now?
They're on hold. I have some really good ideas for books in my head, but honestly, the opportunity to sort of explore being a screenwriter and explore the real thrills of watching an audience see my stuff on stage. I mean, if I can afford to let books rest for a little while and go after screenplays and stage writing, I'm going to give it a shot. It's a crazy business right now in New York. The publishing industry can't figure itself out. The advent of e-books is really chopping into writers' residuals.
E-books and self-publishing.
Yeah. And New York, God bless those guys. They're looking for nothing but blockbusters because there's so much chatter now. There's so many small e-book publishers coming into the fore. So much money's being siphoned away from the big legacy publishers. I looked at my recent royalty statement, and 80% of the books I sold over the last 6 months were ebooks. They were downloads. Now, that sounds good until you realize that a download is like $3, $4, $5. So instead of paying $15 for a paperback or a hardcover and $5, $6, $7 for a paperback, people are now paying $2, $3, $4 for downloads. Well, that means we're splitting $2 and $3 now instead of splitting 20 or 15. So authors' share of this is going down, down, down. The efficiencies in the publishing industry are not being shifted to us. They're not buying trees and paper and trucks. They're sending things out over email, over computers, but that efficiency for them isn't translating to greater residuals for writers. They're keeping it.
Right.
So there's a lot of wrestling going on in the book publishing business, and I don't mind sitting some of that out if I get a chance to make a living and have some fun writing screenplays and stage plays.
And it really does sound like you are having fun.
I'm excited about it. Over the holidays, I read two books on screenwriting before I started writing The Brink, my Cold War screenplay. And pretty soon I'm going to go back to the Haitian one and make it look professional because I'm shocked that anybody paid attention to it now that I realize how amateurish it was. It's a good story, and there's great stuff in it, but in terms of formatting and just the flow of it, I made a zillion mistakes that now I know better. Pretty soon I'm going to go back and do that. And within not much time, I'm hoping that I'll have a screenwriting agent. I don't have one. I haven't bothered to look for one because I've been busy making the material. In short, yes, I'm excited.
It's kind of fun to hear someone who has been so successful and is so well established in the writing field, excited and talking about learning new things. Is that exciting for you?
It kind of goes beyond exciting because, let's face it, you're allotted a certain number of days in this world. And golly, I remember something a buddy of mine said to me in law school decades ago. He said, why spend your life doing what you're good at? And it didn't make any sense to me as a young man, but I get it now. I have an ebullient personality anyway.
No.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought you were a wallflower.
No, and I have a face for radio as well. But I'm also, for those folks who have not, aren't aware of this, I'm also a large guy. Patty, I'm 6'6 and about 260. And I'm a former college jock and stuff. So I'm a large guy, but I've got a small guy's energy, and it weirds people out to be around me when I'm excited. Because if I was a normal-sized person, I'd be an excited guy. But I'm like this monolith that's excited. And so I'm having to be careful about my energies and about how how stoked I get because I don't want to freak people out. I mean, Steve Beauregard, when we met, he literally, we were sitting next to each other, and he literally got up and moved to another chair to put a chair between us. Because I guess I was waving my arms. He didn't want to get hit.
Well, what are you excited about next? Have you got another screenplay behind the brink?
I kind of do, which shouldn't come as a surprise. Lucas Crost, who is a name I hope that everybody gets to hear. He's an immensely talented young man. And what a great guy, too. He's a good father, a good husband. He runs his own company. Got a rage and brain. Bennett Fidlow, who's our attorney and our producer, is another really, really good guy. Again, a good father, good husband. I mean, I like these cats. They're nice men. And we have talked about sort of forming a little company, you know, a little film company. And one of the things about the Haitian movie, and the name of the movie is The Rock and the Sun, from a saying, a Haitian saying that says, the rock in the water will never know the pain of the rock in the sun. It's formatted so that Haitian Relief has a full 20% share of the proceeds of this movie.
Wow.
And one of the things that Lucas and Bennett and I have talked about is continuing to make movies that are socially responsible and give those movies a piece of, give those causes a piece of the movie and do things that are kind of involve maybe a social justice component to our work, which I'm excited about. I really like doing that. For instance, if I were fortunate enough to get The Brink made, I hope that I could work with a production company that would give multiple sclerosis research, you know, some of the proceeds. Lucas and I have talked about a lot of ideas. I don't want to say them now because there's a lot of writers out there. But I've got an idea that sort of revolves around Alzheimer's.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I had an aunt, wonderful lady, my mother's youngest sister, and she had Alzheimer's towards the end and kind of got stuck in a really pleasant place. She kept waiting for my Uncle Al to pick her up for the prom. And it was very pretty, sad, you know, that sort of elegiac. It's like rain with a rainbow all at the same time. You know, you remember those cool times when the sun's out but it's raining and you don't know which to pay the most attention to. And I like sad moments like that that are sad but beautiful, the bittersweet thing.
You have a way, I think, in all of your work of weaving moments like that into what are otherwise very fast-paced, very exciting stories. The art of storytelling, how did the stories come to you? Do they come to you, or do you construct the stories?
You know, another great question, Pat. You're on a roll. But it's one of those things you can't – I don't know that this is something you can teach. I think this is what separates artists from artists from artists. You can look at great painters, and you can see the subject matter and how they treat the subject matter. And I'm an Impressionist fan. I love the everything from Van Gogh up to Monet, Manet, Matisse, that crowd. I love looking at their subject matter because their subject matter all too often is very quotidian. It's flowers. It's a church tower. It's a water wheel. You know, it's children that play in a park. Yet each one of those guys washes those images through their own vision. And I know that when I look at Van Gogh's work, I really feel like I can see his sadness. I can feel that sort of dystopian view he had of the world is right on the canvas. One of my favorite Van Gogh paintings is a self-portrait kind of in three-quarter profile. If you look closely, there's fletches of green and purple in his beard. The guy was a redhead. He didn't have green or purple in his beard. Yet he went back to his palette and he said, purple. And it was perfect. Perfect because it was wrong. And perfect because it was against the grain of what we see. And that was his way of saying, I don't really see purple and green in my beard, but I don't visually see it, but I sense it's there. That's the best way I can explain my own view of the world. I don't really get caught up in my own head of trying to recreate reality. I don't really try to tell a war story, and I don't try to tell a personal story, not from the action standpoint. I like to try to thread through my work what I can only call a sort of sagacious sadness. I even notice these things. I mean, I write for Boomer magazine. When I read the Boomer articles after I've written them, the thread that I see in my own work is it's always at sadder but wiser. My characters tend to be vessels of hard-won wisdom. You know, I don't write about children. They don't know enough. I don't write about happy, successful, rich, carefree people. I think that they're isolated from the kinds of wisdom that fascinate me. My work tends to be about people who are pressured through physical circumstances like war. They're different because they are poor. They may be black in a white community, you know, that's intolerant of them, like scorched earth. Even in the movies, I mean, this is a Haitian earthquake. I mean, there's people in great distress, and you're watching their faith bubble up in God and in each other and the human will. So I think that a story doesn't touch me unless it has that component to it. There's some great stories. And people are all the time saying, oh, you should write about this, write about that. But unless I can feel that kernel of, as I've said, hard-won sagacity, that thing I can depict, but unless I can find a character who is in some sort of agony, physical, mental, emotional, and then I let them fight against that. All too many stories are somebody fighting against a physical thing, an enemy, the cops, a bomb, racing. I like to have people fighting their own limitations. That makes me sound way too artistic, but that's what moves me is Angel. Let's go back to the Brink for a moment. Here's a guy who has been tortured, and he wants vengeance on this guy, Wolf, who did that to him. Yet he falls for the girl, and he knows that he has to give up his vengeance on Wolf. He cannot kill Wolf. He cannot hurt Wolf, because if he does, the girl dies. So he has. So through the whole thing, he struggles with his own nightmares that he's clung to. This cat keeps him awake at night. He doesn't sleep because he dreams about getting even with Wolf. He remembers the torture and the beatings that he suffered. And then this woman walks in his life, and he has to walk away from all that to save her. So extrapolating that feel is what I'm drawn towards.
I would like to stay here and talk with you for another half hour, but unfortunately we are out of time. Will you come back?
Will you invite me?
Absolutely.
The answer is absolutely sure.
Great. Well, we will get you back soon, and good luck with the play and with the screenplays. We'll look forward to going to see both Scorched Earth and going to the movies someday to see both, The Brink and...
The Rock and the Sun.
The Rock and the Sun. Well, David L. Robbins, thank you very much for being with us
on
The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell for The Virginia Voice.